So hello everyone, good afternoon and welcome. This is Romola D from Romola D Reports, and I'm here this afternoon, as you can tell, with a very distinguished panel. This is News Panel 20, and we are doing a focus here on a subject that is very important, very serious, and really heartbreaking, and that desperately needs public attention, media attention, and worldwide political attention in order to bring the situation to an end. We started these Saturday news panels several months ago, bringing up the subject of the UK mothers suffering in the UK family courts. And today we are going to be looking at what happens to UK fathers in the UK family courts. And with an extra touch, most of the people on this panel are veterans. They're veterans of the British Army, the Royal Air Force, or the Royal Navy. And they have all suffered tremendously at the hands of the Child Support Agency and the Child Maintenance Services, imposing fictitious arrears on them, bringing up false claims of money that they owe, and creating huge psychological stress in the families, which has unfortunately resulted in absolute tragedy. We have Ian Briggs here, whose son Gavin unfortunately took his own life. And, you know, we are all absolutely energized and heartbroken by that situation and by the situation that every veteran on this panel has suffered. So this is a very important subject, and I'm going to turn the floor over at this point to Michelle, who brought to my attention the sufferings of the UK mothers at the hands of the family courts and has been doing a brilliant job exposing both the financial crimes and the family crimes in the courts. And a special mention also to Leonard Lawrence and Craig Bullman, who both brought this situation to our attention.
I must say it's an absolute honour, Romola, to be doing another panel with you, and an honour to have such great men on here exposing the truth and the crimes. You know, I believe the family courts, they're secret family courts, and I think it's time that we lift the lid and we make them public family courts, and they should not be kept private, secretive any longer. So let's hand the floor over to who's going to go first, guys.
It's me. I'm in the hot seat.
Oh, great.
You're in the hot seat.
Right.
You have an haircut as well.
Not quite. Right, I'm Craig Bullman. I'm a veteran of the Parachute Regiment, Red Devils Freefall Team, and the Blues and Royals of the Household Cavalry. I was in the Army for 16 years, and then I was hammered by the Child Support Agency, even though I had a private arrangement with my ex-wife, which was amicable, and we were both happy with it. CSA decided that they'd get themselves involved and threatened her to stop her benefits if she did not open a case against me. And in the meantime, they were telling me that she had opened a case. So that caused conflict between us. And then this all happened just before I was going on tour to Bosnia. So, you know, they were telling me I had to pay like £4,000 of arrears, which I didn't know because I'd already been paying in a private arrangement. Obviously caused a lot of distress when I'm just before I was going on an operational tour. When I came back, you know, they set up the detachment of earnings order detachment of earnings request, took massive amounts above and beyond my means because I was left with all the debt from the marriage. And then, you know, I was really stressed out. Then at the finish, I left the Army after 16 years service. Come 2010, they started on me again. And this time I had £12,000 worth of arrears. Where those arrears come from, I've got no idea. Anyway, I challenged them. And as soon as I challenged them, they became very hostile and militant towards me. They then forced me onto a detachment of earnings order, which was 40% of my salary, which did not leave me enough money to pay for my to get to work, to pay for my rent, pay for the council tax, pay for all the household bills, and couldn't afford to eat. And I had been paying substantial amounts of money, voluntarily to cover these arrears until I discovered that these arrears I didn't know. anyway, they really pressed on the brewers, and they used their enforcement to force me to pay like £800 a month, and I couldn't afford it. You know, they said, I really can't afford this. They just didn't, they weren't bothered in the least. And then I had a breakdown at work, and I was sent home from work. As I didn't go to work, I couldn't afford to pay my rent, so I was made homeless. And then that triggered the old PTSD. And the wheels came off. And that's it. And, you know, I was emailing MPs. They're there. They were just ignoring me. And then I eventually got my case to the PHSO, which is Parliamentary Health Service Ombudsman. And the CSA actually admitted that they had done some naughty things to me and gave me £5,000 in consultancy payment, which was an admittance of their guilt. Previous to that, I had, you know, oh God, excuse me a second, bleeding dog. Sorry about that. Yes, they admitted that they shouldn't have done what they did. Sorry about that, guys. Jack Russell's.
Oh, I've got one of those. They never stop barking.
Dog's having its own say, huh? No, not.
Yeah, right. Okay, so anyway, I was made homeless, and they eventually admitted to wrongdoing. I was given £5,000 in a consultancy payment, which obviously didn't cover the damage that they caused to me. You know, I lost it with the old PTSD, and they still haven't put it right. You know, they left me in a very vulnerable, disadvantaged position. The government's not interested in compensating correctly when they're actually supposed to. But this was all fraud, you know. Everything was fraud, you know, all their actions were fraud, been exposed. My case exposes the fact that, you know, there's a thing called ICE, Independent Case Examiner, which is the next process to go through from the ICE, you know, found in favour of the CSA. They said that, you know, I was wrong. And, this is supposed to be an introduction, sorry. Yeah, go on. Right, sorry about that.
There seems to be a little bit of an audio and video kind of freezing going on.
Yes.
Anyway.
Thank you very much, Greg, for your story. Yeah. I mean, that's a whole lot of horrors to deal with. And it sounds like an absolute uphill battle every step of the way, constantly having to go to their offices.
The government knows what's happening as well. The government knows happening, and they're just not interested. The whole lot.
The government is letting it happen, is what you said. Yeah, very sad story.
Yeah, absolutely.
So did Ian Briggs want to pick up and tell Gavin's story
now? I'm Ian Briggs, I do 29 years in the Royal Air Force. Mm. I had a son, Gavin Briggs, who did 15 years in the Royal Air Force. Last July, Gavin took his own life, committed suicide. It was afterwards that we worked out, we found out that basically Gavin had three children by two different marriages who he was paying CMS for. Up until that point, he had been paying his CMS dues. In the last year of his life, we worked out he'd paid £15,000 child maintenance for the three children. So we knew he was paying the money. He had a reasonably good job, so he could afford that and still lead a reasonable life. But the two ex-wives decided that they wanted more money out of him and instigated a financial fraud investigation into him by the CMS. The fraud investigation turned out to be completely and utterly flawed. They said that he earned an additional £26,000 over and above his income. He was on about £50,000 a year normal income. they added £26,000 to that. So they worked out that he was earning supposedly £76,000 a year. On top of that, they came up with this fictitious arrears figure of £15,000. There's no way he could have owed that. He'd only been on the CSA, CMS for about 3 years, and he had been paying it. I have all his bank statements, all everything, and I know that he had been paying regularly the CMS and the child maintenance. On top of that, for two of the kids, he'd been through a court order. So he was paying for two of the kids through an actual court order, which is nothing to do with the CMS. It's outside of them. So he was paying £269 a week for two children. The CMS Fraud Investigation Unit decided that he needed to be paying another £1,000 on top of that. From what I can make out, the CMS didn't take into account the court order that he already had in place. So when we added all the figures up, effectively, the CMS was expecting Gavin to pay £2,669 a month in child maintenance for three kids. This would effectively have left him with about £153 a week to live on. He appealed twice. I know he appealed twice because I have the letters from the CMS, and they just didn't take any notice of him. They wouldn't listen to him. They wouldn't take any of his evidence that he put forward was taken into account, nothing. They just carried on with the same fraudulent activity to the point that he just had nowhere left to go. Since he took his own life, I've been trying to deal with the CMS. Although I'm his father, they will not speak to me because he has three boys, and they are considered to be his next of kin, even though they're minors. The CMS will not talk to me at all. And I found out this week when I phoned them up, they now have a note on their files that nobody is to say anything to me at all. We're going through a inquest. So I've had two pre-inquest hearings with the coroner. The last one was on Thursday. I spent an hour and 20 minutes with the coroner trying to convince him to take into account the CMS wrongdoing. And he's just refusing to take it into account. He's just disregarding it. He says it's nothing to do with him. What I'm trying to do is, at the end of the day, I know I'll never get Gavin back, but I'm trying to prevent further people ending up in the same situation as Gavin did. So I'm requesting from the coroner a Section 28, which is a prevention of future deaths. So basically, the coroner should carry out an investigation, find out what went wrong. He's not there to find anybody guilty. He's not there to prove anybody's guilt or anything like that. All he's supposed to do is find out what went wrong and ensure that measures are put in place to prevent those mistakes being made again. And he's refusing to do it. It's just absolute, nobody wants to do anything about this. I have written to, my name is probably famous in the Houses of Parliament. I've written to Theresa Coffey. I've written to Arlene Sugden. I've written to my MP. I've eventually got my MP to start doing something about it. I've written to the, the veterans representative in Parliament, which was Johnny Mercer. I never even heard back from him. Nobody will take any notice of what is going on. They just want to sweep it under the carpet, and it is just horrendous. Basically, that's my story as far as I go at the moment.
That's disgusting.
Yeah.
Absolutely tragic story. Thank you, Ian. It's absolutely shocking that the CMS won't speak to you. I don't even know if is that even legal? I mean, how can they get away with that?
It's because there's a hierarchy of people who can be administrator of Gavin's estate. Because he died in estate, there was no will. They go down the list of people who can be made administrator. And the first ones on the list is obviously spouse, then comes children, and then comes parents. So because there are children, they won't talk to me. I've written to the Secretary of State ages ago asking, she can make me the administrator. She has the power to make me the administrator of the estate, but she ignored me. I've been talking to my MP and we've written to her again about 2 weeks ago now, and I've still heard nothing back. But until I'm administrator of the estate, the CMS, unfortunately, hiding behind GDPR rules, which GDPR rules only apply to the living, but they're using those rules to refuse to speak to me or tell me anything that's going on.
How old was he?
He was 40.
That's disgusting. Yeah,
we just celebrated his 40th birthday.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Is there a possibility of recontacting that MP? And what is her name? Who is she? The one who has refused to respond to your letters?
Teresa Coffey. The first response I got back was, we can't talk to you because of GDPR rules. And this time I've had no response at all. Johnny Mercer, who was the veterans representative in Parliament until he just resigned recently. I got nothing back from him at all. He's not interested. And my MP, it's taken me about 6-7 months to actually get him to start looking into it and doing something about it. I've just been badgering him. And eventually I think I embarrassed him into actually doing something. So he is now starting to do something. But this is now, I'm seven months down the road. I've got the inquests in next month and I needed to get everything in place for this inquest, but I'm just not going to be able to get it in place.
I noticed there was a bit of coverage recently about the coroner, yes. Right? Your conversation.
Yeah, that was Thursday's, my last episode with the coroner on Thursday. And I say it was an hour and 20 minutes and it was like being in a boxing ring with this guy. He just completely and utterly refuses to accept that the CMS had part of causing what Gavin did. Ironically, it wasn't just the CMS where Gavin worked, the company that Gavin worked for. He was trying to do the right thing. They were not doing things correctly. There were people signing for work that wasn't being done, et cetera, et cetera. So Gavin was trying to put it right from within the company. He's a bit like me. He likes things to be done properly and correctly. The company were trying to sack him, so he was basically going to get the sack. On the day that he took his own life, he was supposed to be in a hearing and he was going to lose his job, basically. I went to Hitachi with Gavin's fiance. We went to Hitachi because we knew everything that was going on because Gavin talked to us, took everything to them. They actually took it on board. They went away and they have spent millions. And in this last, 8 months now, they have spent millions and they have started to put things right. They have changed things. They haven't actually admitted that they did anything wrong, which I never thought they would. But they have realised that they have had to change their ways and do things differently to make sure that nobody's put in the same position that Gavin was by then. And that's all I want from the coroner, but he's refusing to do it, and the CMS, and they're both refusing to do it.
But the saddest point, you, is for those viewers who you've got all over the world, the Department of Works and Pensions is a government body, and it's actually been privatised to a corporate organisation who got coal handlers. And the coroner, Regulation 28, which Ian talks about, report of prevention to prevent future deaths, it has actually been raised previously by in another coroner's report where the coroner's actually recommended for the DWP, this organisation, which collects the child maintenance, that the call handlers of the DWP, what they've said is, had not received any in their preparatory course prior to commencing work for taking calls from claimants who, everybody on here is a claimant, their client. They hadn't received specific training as how to best interact with persons suffering from mental ill health in such a way as to avoid at the end of the day, not making their problems even more. Mental health, biggest stresses of mental health, mental well-being, we all suffer it, is money, relationship breakdown, and change in circumstances, which led to where Gavin is. And the coroner now is refusing to look at that. That's detrimental. You know, every one of these individuals on you, I would openly state, has contemplated taking their own life one time or another due to the way the call handlers operate, you know, and that's the saddest thing.
And Clive, you are someone who's been following the stories of many of the veterans who've suffered at the hands of CMS and CMA, right? I've watched a few of your videos. Did you have a story of your own to bring to the table today?
I'm lucky I never got pursued by the CMS. However, I've had other dealings where I've lost a lot of veteran friends to suicide. And one was horrifically murdered due to mental well-being. So Craig reached out to me, and Craig, I was talking about, because I've gone through my own traumas and I didn't get the support that was required by the government, and they actually blacked out a lot of stuff in the media. They do media blackout. And I was part of an horrific murder to a very close friend who they led down. And they blacked it out, the media. So Craig came to me and we started talking. And I could see the resemblance of what goes on within the CMS. And I've actually started doing podcasts with Craig, and I've actually helped quite a few people who have been suicidal after coming off the phone with CMS. We've got veterans, we've got serving personnel, we've got serving personnel within the elite forces of the British military who are more frightened of their government they serve than the actual people they pursue, the terrorists they pursue. So something's got to change, because this is wrong. This is really, I've reached out to MPs. We've reached out, everybody on you probably reached out to their MPs, and we just get ignored. There's no problem. We have letters back from the Cabinet Office telling us there's no problem, which is really sad.
You know, I've been investigating, this is serious fraud, a murder. I've been investigating this for 15 years. And what I've seen with the family court frauds and the bankruptcy court frauds, the judges, a lot of the law firms have got blood on their hands.
Yeah.
And this has to be fully exposed. The family courts have to be made public courts, no longer secretive family courts. And I think this is a very good place for us all to start and to organise to make sure that this does not happen to any other families. And it's time that we the people now really make a stand and organise ourselves to stop this.
The thing is, Michelle, I get drawn back all the time to the speech Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II made on the 40th year of her reign. And it's raised by a senior officer who's fighting for justice at the moment, Graham House. And he kept putting it up to us. And every one of the individuals on here have served Her Majesty. And what she said is, no, before there can be no doubt, of course, that criticism is good for people and institutions that are part of the public life. No institution, city, monarchy, whatever, should expect to be free from scrutiny of those who give it their loyalty and support, not to mention those who don't. But we are all part of the same fabric of our national society, and that scrutiny by one part of another can be just as effective if it is made with good touch of good gentleness, good humour and understanding. This sort of questioning can also act, and it should do so, as an effective engine for change. However, nobody is, they don't like criticism, the government. They don't like accountability. And a lot of the stories you're going to hear now, and I'm going to step aside to allow everybody else to say, they do not take to accountability.
And that's what we have to change.
Definitely. But they're the words of our Majesty, Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. And it doesn't mean anything. That's where we are. So I'm going to step back now and let others have this in, definitely.
Thank you for establishing that the government is eluding accountability and responsibility in this matter. That is a huge point. And who would like to be the next to speak?
I'll go next if you want.
Thank you.
I started off with the CSA in 1993. I left the army in 92 after 9 years service. I was hounded first by them with saying that I owed arrears when I'd only just started. They then took £1,300 off me 1 month and left me £3 to live on. That went on for 6 months. Luckily, there was a good manager in my company, which I knew, Keith House, who I spoke to, because I said to him I'd had enough. We'd already lost one veteran I knew to the CSA, Mac. He went out on the moors and committed suicide. Luckily, somehow, Keith got it brought down. Then you go up to, I got divorced. I then met this lady. I had twin boys. They were born in 1998. I paid by CSA, then the CMS, by DEO on my wages since 1993. Never missed a payment. Got to 2016 when I finished with my first children. Then obviously my second children finished then in 2016, my boys. I then was told I was £9,000 in arrears. I've been fighting them for since 2016. They have now come back. Oh, sorry, I start again. I then, Craig helped me. I then got into ICE. They went through the so-called investigation, which is a load of rubbish. They then said I owed £5,000 in arrears. They wrote £4,000 off because it was owed to the Chancellor Exchequer back then, which was CSA money. And then ICE did their completion last July. They've now come back and said I owe £25,000 in arrears. I'm now paying £475 a month out of my money. I'm 53 this year. I can't retire now because I've got £25,000 over my head. And Craig, if Craig's still there, but Craig's brilliant. He's helped me so much, and he's helped me with my partner as well, because my partner wasn't very well. She had a brain hemorrhage in 2006. And things just went downhill, really gone downhill now. And I've had enough now, really have had enough.
So sorry to hear all of this. I guess all of us are. I mean, it's horrifying.
Well, my case is with the PHSO at the moment. And I spoke to James Glover, who Craig's involved with now as well, because I've asked him to become involved with it. And James Glover's going to make a decision next week on what's going to happen. Whether they're going to write this money off or I'm going to have to take it to a tribunal. I'm also paying for a solicitor now myself. I'm trying to get it to a tribunal, as Clive knows. And they're as for like the father lost his son. I live in Plymouth, and Johnny Mercer lives in Plymouth. So if you ever want me to correspond with him, you just let me know. But yes, they are so dangerous. They are, they, you know, like I said, Matt was a good friend of mine, and he just went up the moors one day and just committed suicide. And that was it. Because they left him with 5 pence to live on.
And how, which agencies in particular are you speaking about? Is it the child maintenance?
CSA first.
CSA yeah. first. Okay.
And then they transfer over to the CMS, didn't they?
They transfer over to the CMS. Yeah. So both of these agencies, how would you rate their level of responsiveness? Are either of them, is there a difference in the level of responsiveness to you?
They're nasty. They're taught to be very, very nasty people. They're taught to bring you down. They're taught to make you feel like you want to walk out that door and not come back. Because that's what they do. That's what they do.
Do they act like debt collectors rather than
support
people?
I'm leaving my company on the 28th of May because DHL's been merged with another company. I said to them, well, I'm leaving DHL on the 28th of May. And this woman turned around and said, oh, well, we'll just take your license off you, one, so you can't work. And then we'll get debt collectors to come into your house and take everything in your house. And, you know, that's what they're like.
It's a very antagonistic, adversarial kind of approach.
Especially when the arrears are fictitious, they're using excessive enforcement to collect money, which is not even owed in the first place.
Well, I don't have any money.
No, he doesn't owe the money at all. It's a case of false accounting. They're under investigation by the National Audit Office again.
Yeah.
It's actually debt slavery, isn't it, really?
Yeah, yes. That's exactly where it is.
But
it's modern-day slavery.
Yes, Clive, you were trying to say something.
The thing is, remember, Child Maintenance Services is run by the Child Maintenance Group, which is a corporate company. It's a private company. They turned over 38, 40 million profit last year, okay? And what you've got to remember now, the Child Maintenance Services, and there'll be people watching this going, oh, yeah, you know, the fathers who these fathers are paying for their children, okay? And but they are paying also for the fathers who are not paying for their children because they are seen as easy targets. So they're paying much more and beyond, all right? And this is what I need to get across to people because these guys on you are paying, but they're coming at them because they're soft targets and they're coming at them because they've got to reach their targets. It's a private organization working on behalf of the government. And it was set up for the benefit of the children, to protect the children. However, the children at this moment in time, we've got Gavin who's committed suicide. He's got children. Now you've got children without a father figure, and it's cost the economy 1.7 million. Each suicide costs 1.7 million in the United Kingdom. So, you know, that's the biggest thing people need to take away from this is these guys on you are paying for their children. Some of them don't even see their children, which is sad.
It sounds like these fathers are being exploited and
yes.
False claims are being made. They're being asked to pay even more money than they should be paying or should rightfully be paying, right? According to the setup or, I mean, what exactly determines how much a father should pay?
Tony, Mark, once Mark finishes, they've all got their own stories there. And what determines it, they do a salary count from, is the HMRC, Craig?
Yeah, it is. HMRC now, yeah.
And it's actually...
Clive, shall I give a summary? Because I've written some extensions.
Yeah, Brian, you were better
please
off.
Please do. Gotta...
So the criteria for calculations is there's several. It's how much are you earning? How many children do you have? And how many nights do the children stay with you per week? So when you combine those, the less time you have with your children, the more you will pay, and the more children you have, the more you will pay, and obviously the more money you earn, the more you will pay. That those three things can collide to essentially mean that it's unaffordable. Even in my circumstances, in the report that I'm nearly completing, you know, the average paying parent must be earning £40,000 a year at least, in order to be able to have one child that they're paying for, who they have three nights a week. So they're paying the very lowest amount on that. You know, so for them to be able to meet their basic living costs and pay child support, if they're not earning £40,000 a year before tax, they will start to fall into arrears. So if you then take that to a parent who's paying, who has three children or more, and they don't have them any nights a week, then that can multiply a number of times, up to thousands of pounds a month, as is the case with Ian's son, Gavin. You know, so there's a clear incentive for the receiving parent to restrict contact, you know, clear financial incentive to do that, and with very little, you know, the paying parent is helpless to stop that, and they can't all of a sudden create a bigger job. You know, they can't create a bigger income just because someone says, well, you owe us that. But there's also another factor here, is that the more that they are assessed to need to pay, the more they will ultimately say, well, I need to earn more money, so I'll work more hours, I'll try and get a promotion, or, you know, they'll get busier, they'll take on more responsibility. So the government, of course, then taxes them at a higher rate. So there's a direct tax incentive to the government for the paying parent to be under as much financial pressure as possible, because they will, in most circumstances, just somehow try to find the money. They will take on another job. They will do overtime. They will, you know, they will study. They will, you know, try and go up the ranks at work in order to get a higher paying job. But, you know, you can very often be on an £80,000 a year salary and still not even be breaking even at the end of the month after meeting your basic living costs, if you've got two or three children that you're not seeing very often. And if you are seeing them, of course, you've got to have an environment that you can look after them, and you need to spend money on them, and nobody's taking consideration of that. And of course, the receiving parent is receiving all of that money tax free. But that money is being generated and taxed at a higher band. So the government is really benefiting from not utilizing the tax-free allowances that the receiving parent, who probably either isn't working or is only working part-time or on a lower salary, if they are working part-time, they're not utilizing all of their allowable lower tax thresholds. So when you calculate all of that, as I've done in my report, based on the average paying parent profile, you're looking at over £3.5 billion a year in stealth tax that the government is pocketing.
£3.65 billion.
So there's a clear financial incentive to government. You know, this isn't about tackling deadbeat dads. This is an extortion. It's an extortion racket, and most of the money that they're extorting, actually, we're not seeing. You know, it's stealth. You know, it's the increase to employers' national insurance. It's the increase in the paying parent needing to move up the tax bands. You know, it's the increase in their national insurance that they're paying. You know, they're needing to pay for another property to live in. There's duplication of expenses. All of these things lead to extra taxes being paid. And I'm only, the 3.65 billion is only looking at the wage, you know, the wage difference. When you calculate the tax impact, and it's staggering, you know.
I'm just thinking out loud. What I'm going to do with the bankruptcy frauds, I'm going to do a class A action, because the documents are forged and their assets stripping people unlawfully. Could you not do a class A action on a private prosecution with this?
I'd love to. Yeah, I mean, I'd love to. I think the biggest problem for all of us is that we're, you know, we are asset stripped, and we are very light in resources and in legal support. So, you know, I'm trying to address creating an organization that will remedy that to some degree. But these things take time, you know.
Can I just say something there?
Yeah.
To back Brian up, when I first started out on my journey, I approached 5 different solicitors and none of them would take my money. None of them would take the case on. They just were not interested. They will not take on the CMS.
As soon as you mention the Child Support Agency or the Child Maintenance Service, they're not interested. They're even though you've got a good case of misconduct in the public office and fraud, all that sort of stuff, law firms will not go anywhere near them, regardless.
Yeah, I mean, let's remember that the law, you know, especially the family law industry, is making a killing off the back of these organisations. So they're not going to stop. They're not going to stop. Yeah, they're not going to start biting the hands that feed them, and they're playing a part in it. So strategically, we have to find different ways of doing this.
I've got an idea, but I'm working on something now. If you give me a couple of months and you work out how many people you'd like, maybe I can help you organise a Class A action on a private prosecution in the next few months. Yeah?
Yeah. Well, let's have a chat offline. Yeah.
This is really interesting because I remember, Michelle, in the first panel with the UK Mothers, one of the problems was the litigation loan funding, right? The extra loan funding, the second loans. So yeah. The solicitors who did come forward to help the mothers ended up putting them in greater debt through all of these bogus loans.
The difference is, though, that's the problem. They've been going into the family courts and the insolvency courts, which are rigged. But if you do this on a private prosecution, it's criminal. There's a difference, and that's what I'm trying next. But I'm in the middle of organising something. I'm working very long hours to organise that. If that works for me, guys, I will actually put in you in touch with the same people. But I don't want to give too much of my strategy away at the moment until it's done. But I'm getting there, and it's not done in this country.
Yeah.
And say no more than that at this stage.
Yeah. Sure. Well, thank you, Brian, for all of that insight into how this is all working. And boy, we are learning more as you all bring information to the table over here. You know, it's not just the government, it's this Child Support Agency and the CMS and the fact that lawyers won't touch it and that there's some kind of, you know, behind the scenes network where they're all sort of permitting the situation to go on because it is lucrative for each of them. In an underhanded way. It's kind of mind-blowing. So who would like to go next?
Well, shall I just tell you a summary of my experience?
Yeah, please do.
So the fictitious arrears that have been created quite recently, actually, for me, are based on... unearned, what they call unearned income. So while I was, prior to my separation from my now ex-wife, I drew down a director's loan from the company that I ran at the time, which has now been destroyed. We were still together at the time. And my ex-spouse was responsible for spending almost all of that money. When we separated, I then, you know, the company was already in real difficulty from her spending. So I didn't take a salary for a couple of years trying to save the business. And Child Maintenance Service, after her making a fraudulent application, looked back at that director's loan. They call it unearned income, which is just bizarre, I think. Because it's not earnings. If you haven't earned it, it's not income, it's a loan. So they ignored that fact. They ignored the fact that I had no salary after that. They ignored the fact that she spent most of that money. They ignored her poor conduct in driving my business to destruction, making me homeless and vexatious litigation, making us all homeless. They've done a calculation based on that unearned income. And soon after, I had to declare bankruptcy in February last year. So I'm not bankrupt anymore. But, you know, essentially they put me in a position where I couldn't earn. They weren't responsible for me being bankrupt. That was really down to family court, who had an opportunity to stop that from happening and chose not to. So essentially the position now is that they want me to pay her £15,000 based on money that she spent when we were together before the divorce was even initiated. And for me to be able to do that, if I were to pay that off over, let's say, a year and a half, I would have to earn £80,000 a year. That, of course, would mean that they would reassess me to pay her more every month on top. So I would need an £80,000 a year job, and that would just about cover after tax my basic living expenses, which are very modest, I assure you. It's just, you know, the effect of taxation. And, you know, only 2% of jobs pay 80 grand or more. So, you know, arguably it's restraint of trade. You know, I mean, I probably am capable of an 80 grand a year job. I don't really fancy it, to be honest with you. I don't want that kind of responsibility. I don't really want to encourage the person that did all of this by ensuring that she receives more money for doing very little. I have my son 3 days a week anyway, and you know, I'm fortunate in that. But you know, obviously I have expenses on top to be able to, you know, when I say £80,000, you know, that would be just to get rid of that fictitious debt in a reasonable time period, you know, of a year and a half. In that year and a half, I wouldn't have any money for a holiday. I wouldn't have any money for, you know, for entertainment. I wouldn't be able to do any out of school activities with my son. You know, it's a very meager life. So, you know, in the real world, who wants to take on all the responsibility of an 80 grand a year job for nothing? That's the bottom line, is who, you know, I'm not doing it for me. It feels like slave labor. I mean, it's probably, you know, when you look at the laws on modern slavery, it seems to me that it breaches those laws.
I agree.
Yeah.
And to be labeled a deadbeat dad for your trouble, you know, so it's really, you know, and I watched a video just yesterday where it's even worse in the States. And, you know, it's encouraging crime, because some dads are so desperate to be able to meet their basic costs that they're either, you know, defrauding the CMS to hide income, or they're going out and committing crime in order to pay these fictitious arrears. And then they're getting caught and they're getting sent to prison. You know, it's encouraging desperate acts, and it's probably resulting in, you know, violent reactions in some cases, you know, where they're driven to such despair that they're either going to harm themselves or they're going to harm someone else. And you know, it's difficult to say that that's not understandable. You know, we're all humans and we can only take so much. And you could probably make a case for being surprised that they're not being more of it. But, you know, you wouldn't treat dogs this way.
It seems like they've been kind of ruthless in your case. They refuse to take into account anything. They're kind of like a brick wall. You can't speak to them. They don't acknowledge anything.
You know, I went through the appeal process, and what you find in the appeal process is that they've written regulations that allow them to do it. So far as they're concerned, you go through a tribunal, and the judge is looking through these regulations, and the judge's job is to uphold the regulations. The fact that the regulations in themselves are crazy and they don't work in the real world, and they're plainly fraud, they're plainly a regulation that's built to create to allow them to defraud someone. But in the practice of the tribunal, they are upholding the regulations that are there, and you're just like, you know, this doesn't work in the real world. I can't make this work for you in the real world. You fabricated a set of arrears. You're adding another 20% on top for you for a tri-party financial transaction that is unheard of. And you know, you've got the government making laws around other financial transactions. You know, you've got the FSA that would come down like a ton of bricks on a private organization doing this, you know, in the world of a financial service. But the government organization is doing it every day of the week to hundreds of thousands of paying parents. And, you know, and they're driving up the scale of it. So, the research that I'm doing is showing that in the last 5 years, case numbers have doubled. You know, I mean, literally, I mean, they've doubled. So, you know, that's against the background of a lower birth rate, a lower divorce rate, a significantly lower domestic abuse rate. You know, all of the numbers are saying that the case numbers should be going down, not up, but they're doubling, you know, and yet the claimants, when they're making claims, they're all registering to waive their £20 fee on the basis that they are, you know, domestic abuse victims. And that's, you know, 60% of them are claiming to be domestic abuse victims, which is preposterous. You know, it's completely absurd.
60% of the spouses, you mean?
60% of the claiming parents, you know, who are claiming child maintenance are claiming that they are victims of domestic abuse to waive the £20 application fee. You know, I mean, it's a system that's been built to be gamed.
Yeah, and they play one partner against the other. They're playing men against women to rack up fees to destroy families, basically.
Yeah. And, you know, that's leading to a thousand excess deaths in the paying parent population every year, over 1,000. And, you know, those children, you know, lose a parent forever. They go through the premature loss of that parent, all of the trauma associated to that, you know, and that's chaos in the rest of their lives. That's probably poverty for the rest of their childhood and long beyond. You know, that's tripling their chance of suicide, the likelihood that they will die by suicide. It's we've all been buried in it for so long. But when you get into the actual numbers and you start to calculate it, the social destruction that sits behind this organisation and Family Court is just absolutely mind-bending. And you could make a case for it being responsible for just about every social issue that we've got, that we'll have some sort of link back to Family Court.
It's psychological warfare against children and against families and against the fathers, most definitely. And it also seems to me, just listening to you, you mentioned the term deadbeat dads, which, you know, many people have heard. It seems to be, and, you know, that's pointed up in mainstream media quite a bit, definitely in the US. And it seems like there's kind of a conspiracy, you know, I hate to use that word, but it does seem like it's warranted over here. There's a conspiracy here among a bunch of organizations to create and promulgate that phenomenon, or that bogeyman, the mythology of the deadbeat dad, you know, to kind of ramp it up. There may be deadbeat dads out there who don't pay, right? There's probably figures to that effect. But to take people who are very engaged in their family's welfare, who are paying for the child's support and upkeep, and then to push them through all of these means into poverty and absolute psychological stress and trauma with false claims, fictitious arrears, etc., seems to be kind of supporting and bolstering that phenomenon of the deadbeat dad.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, if you create social dysfunction, you perpetuate an industry around pretending that you're mending it, you know. What's the saying? A fool is the man who fixes the problem that pays his wages, you know? This industry doesn't seem to want to fix problems. It seems to want to perpetuate them because the careers require that. Certainly in terms of family law solicitors, they're making hugely inflated incomes through raiding family estates. And the fact that it's estimated that family court judges, 90% of them have partnerships in law firms, you know, to me, that's a clear conflict of interest. But if you are one of those 90%, you know, you're going to want to have as much dysfunction as possible because the law firm you've got shares in is benefiting and you're therefore getting dividends and what have you. Plus you're getting somewhere between 150 grand a year to 250 grand a year for listening to parents squabble all day.
I didn't know that. Do you know, that's a major point that you've just exposed. So 90% of the family court judges have
I mean, it's an estimate and I can't cite the source, you know, but what I do know is that Ministry of Justice allow it. There's no restriction on that. that there absolutely ought to be a restriction. If you're, you know, I mean, that you go into the judiciary as a former lawyer, you don't, you know, you're a lawyer first and maybe a barrister, and then you become a judge or you go into politics. You know, I mean, 20% of parliament is former lawyers. You know, I mean, that's a pretty high percentage for one profession.
Wow.
But that's the kind of thing that also came out of our earlier panels, didn't it, Michelle? The connection between the judges and the lawyers, the litigation law firms as well.
Yeah.
But that's huge, Ramona, because what wasn't exposed is that around 90% of the judges have got interest in the law firms. So how are you meant to go in there and get justice? Because they're colluding.
Completely colluding.
It's racketeering.
Well, it does. They don't want justice. You know, they just want, you know, I mean, look, you know, you've got the president of the family division, Andrew McFarlane, said in a radio interview about a year ago on, I think it was on Radio 4, they were talking about, you know, the continued rise in cases. And he said to the person interviewing him, it's a head scratcher. We don't know why parents keep coming, you know, and the cases keep rising. And if he was running, if he was the chief exec of any private firm, you know, of any significance, and his shareholders said to him, what's going on with this thing that's causing us all this trouble? And he said, oh, it's a head scratcher. He'd be out the door in a flash. I mean, and it's not a head scratcher. It's plainly obvious what the problems are. This industry has been created. There should be no industry here. You know, you just make it mandatory at separation that it's 50-50 care of the kids. There's no financial incentive for parental alienation. If there's domestic abuse that's proven or provable, it goes to a criminal court. And woe betide you if you make false allegations, you're going to go down. And it would stop overnight and you'd get maybe 10% of the cases left. And that's exactly what's happened in Sweden. You know, 2% of separating parents go to family court in Sweden. Over here, 88% of divorcing parents with dependent kids turn to family court, 88%. You know, claims of domestic abuse within family court cases are 21 times the prevalence in the rest of society.
And this is voluntarily without the child support agency getting involved of their own volition?
This typically happens before CSA gets, child support agency gets involved, you know, CMS, child maintenance service gets involved. There's a family court battle first, you know, and, it, you know, the on separation, you know, it's the money follows the child, right? You know, so that's quite perverse, personally, I think, is, you know, you've got an incentive. So whoever decides that they're leaving the partnership goes to see a family law solicitor and they're given the blueprint. This is what you need to do to maximise your chances and to give you the best way forward, you know, make these accusations. I mean, I've had documentation sent to me that was shared by accident between a family lawyer and their client, where this family lawyer is clearly grooming this woman to be a domestic abuse victim. You know, I'm ever so worried about you. And that's very controlling behavior that he's, you know, that he wants to have 50-50 care, you know, and you know, I'm really worried about you. You know, it goes back to the lawyers. It's perverse. Yeah, it's really perverse.
But remember, when a relationship breaks up, all right, it's change. Money comes into effect. Life stresses. Relationship breakup absolutely drives mental health because the person with the children will think automatically, they're getting on with their life. I'm stuck with your children now. You are going to go off and flaunt it. So straight away, they have mind where they are. It's all to do with mental health and the way they play the game. Mental health makes money. Why don't we teach people in school about money and mental health? Because it's not in the government's interest because we love debt society. We love a society which is built on debt. And that's where we are. It makes money.
You know? Yeah, I mean, the only part I would disagree with you on there is that I think that the majority of people that separate would probably be okay with it if there wasn't a big battle, right? Even if there are kids, yeah. there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of uncertainty, and that, you know, there's vulnerability on both parents' sides, which so for there to be predatory family law solicitors hovering overhead, ready to pounce and to exploit that is really wrong. And you could avoid all of that if there were, for example, a mandatory prenup, or, you know, if you're going to have children with anyone, you know, we all essentially say, I'm not having children with you unless you sign up to this contract that says if we separate, this is how we behave.
You have a contract in place before you.
Yeah.
Yes.
This how we behave when we separate. And we're going to share care. We're going to make sure that we're both in as good condition as we can be. Therefore, we don't need to worry that one of us is going to disappear with the kids. We don't need to worry about us, you know, not having enough money. We're going to make sure lawyers don't get our money. If there's domestic abuse and you're going to accuse me or I'm going to accuse you, then you better bloody well have evidence. Because, you know, if you don't, then you're liable to me. You know, make there be some consequence, you know.
Go ahead, Mark. You were trying to say something.
Not all of us involved in this mess were in a relationship.
No, I know. I mean, it's not a 100% thing, you know, and you'd have to build where you can some safety nets where it's a different set of circumstances. But, you know, in the majority, and I don't know what the actual number is, let's say if it's 80%, at least you've tackled 80% of the likely cases. And then you can look at what are the nuances in all the other cases. And, you know, what can you do to remedy that, to try and take conflict out of that and take the problems out of that? You know, there's never going to be a one size fits all in something this complicated.
Can I throw my little bit in, can I, guys?
Go on, Mark.
Yeah, please tell us your story.
Okay, so you're going to hear quite a few similarities here. And I rarely dip my foot back in this emotional pool. But here we go. So it was a one-night stand in Germany to a British girl in 2002 who afterwards said that she used me to get pregnant. You know, whatever. I won't go too far into it. Anyway, in 2002, I got a detachment of earnings when I was still in the army as a senior NCO in the Royal Corps of Signals for £474 a month, which is not unlike somebody else's. I think Brian's, or no, Mark's at the bottom was £475 a month. So I sought some legal advice from the military legal officer in a place called Bulford. It was Colonel Wellerby Everard, who informed me that I should only be paying 15% for one child and not 33.3% that I was actually paying for one child. So that's all I paid. I paid the 15%. And that money that wasn't paid has been added up over the years, you know. I was suffering from depression at the time, and I didn't realise that I was. So I terminated my service after nearly 18 years. And I got out of the armed forces because I couldn't deal with the pressure that the CSA was putting me under. That consequently landed me homeless after 9 weeks. I had to call in with a change of circumstances and tell them that I was homeless. And they are very, very robotic in their dealings with us. They said that they needed an address for me, otherwise they wouldn't talk to me. So I had to give them my change of address, which it was a blue Volkswagen Passat I was staying in at a place called Scotch Corner in Yorkshire. And she started to type this down. Oh, I've got tingles now. She started to type this down as my address, which is absolutely ridiculous. You know, so these are the type of people that we're having to deal with. I went through two changes of circumstances over the years with them, and not one of them was recorders. My death was passed over to, first of all, a company called Cabot Financial, which I refused to pay. And secondly, a company called Eversheds Debt Recovery, who kindly sent the bailiffs around to my parents' house. I can't remember the year. I've had brain surgery since then, so I can't remember the year. But that particular day didn't go well, you know, when the bailiffs were banging on my mother and father's door. I didn't react very well to that. Breakdown after breakdown, constant pressure from the CSA. I thought it would be easy for me just to leave the country, so I left the country to go and work away overseas. You know, and I did. I, like many others, have done that for quite a few years. Now that I'm back in the UK, it's easier for me not to have a job and live off my war pension and my savings, because I've turned a job down for 70-odd grand a year, 75,000 a year, because as soon as I go back on that radar and I owe them an arrears, an amount of arrears, they will hammer me for up to 40% of my wage until everything's paid, and then still take a monthly payment from me, which at £75,000 is going to be a lot of money. So I'd rather just stay off the radar, live happily on my war pension and my savings. Incidentally, the child was only proven to be mine in November of 2015. She's currently 18 and a half. I've never seen the child. And to date, I've paid about £72,000 to date for that one night.
Was that a choice on your part to never see the child or hers?
No, I asked to see her. I wanted to do the stand-up thing. You know, I believe that a child should be brought into this world by two loving parents, you know, who are both stable enough to bring up that child. Not a one-night stand. That's not how a child should be brought into the world. But me being me, I wanted to do the gentlemanly thing, do the right thing. And it didn't work like that. You know, she absolutely hammered me for money. I was flying to Germany every weekend, trying to keep things going. And it was just a horrible situation. You know, I wrote letters to CSA, who said that they passed them on to the mother. It's just a dead end. I haven't heard a thing. And frankly, now I don't want to hear from her. I'm now in a really good relationship with two children that call me dad, and I'm very, very happy, you know, and I want that to keep going.
It's tragic all around, though, isn't it? And it's sort of a very strange kind of situation.
It's horrible. It's absolutely horrid. And to sit here and listen to, I mean, like, I know Clive, I know Craig, and I know Tony. But, you know, to listen to these stories that have come out, Mr. Briggs, salute you for your bravery, sir. Well done. It's horrific, you know? But
It has to stop. It has to stop.
It has to stop. But I think most of us that are in this have been pushing water uphill, you know, and will probably continue to do so until somebody gets a hold of them and hurts them.
And both you and Brian have talked about how literally you're being given an incentive not to work, not to get a job with a high-paying salary, etc. But in your case, to simply just to live on your army pension.
So. Yeah, I mean, look, you know, I used to have 30 staff.
Sorry, Brian, it's better for my mental health. And that's more important to me. If I start getting involved in all this again, I'll just go down that rabbit hole again. And it's not a nice place to go, you know, even though I know how to get out of it now, but I don't want to go down there. So I will happily live a humble and modest lifestyle with my partner and my two kids now and stay off that radar, right? And then that is the best way for me to live and be happy. So
I think most guys in that, or paying parents in this position, feel the same. Mm-hmm. You know, I certainly do. You know, I I've never been a materialistic person. I just happened to be quite good at making money. But it made me a target, and I don't want to be a target again. And I'm all the more a target now. I didn't expect to be a target of government agencies and courts and lawyers. I didn't expect that. I assumed that there was a justice system that functioned the way the public believes that it functions, but it doesn't. It doesn't exist. And, you know, not only will the government not take this on, the industry itself won't take it on for obvious reasons. The press won't take it on. I mean, ultimately, when you start criticising the judiciary and government institutions, you're going right to the heart of law and order. And the public are like, well, this sounds like a conspiracy to me. You know, but the reality is that at the rate of growth of this industry, it's more likely than not that, you know, my son, who's 9 now, when he's having kids, it's more likely than not that this will happen to him. So that's why I stay involved. And I would probably walk away like Mark has. If that wasn't the case, I would just leave the country and escape it. But I can't tolerate the idea of watching my son go through this. You know, I watched my parents watch me go through it, and it nearly killed them watching me, you know. And I see what they're going through as elderly people, you know. So the tentacles of this and the ripples that are caused through the rest of family and through friendships and through workmates and other connections are obscene. It's not just the individual that's targeted that feels the pain of it. You know, you've got, of course, Ian and his wife, and, you know, any, I don't know what other children they may have, and cousins and uncles and aunts and, you know, the best mates, and his, you know, Gavin's fiance. You know, it's for every one suicide there is, 6 people are deeply impacted by that, you know. And it's no wonder that we're getting so much dysfunction. So going back to what Mark is saying about wanting to sit back, you know, I know that I could set up another business. I've had 30 staff before. I've turned over 3.5 million. I've been paying hundreds of thousands of pounds a year in taxes, you know, only for them to be used against me. You know, dare I do that again? Well, I don't, is the answer. You know, I don't dare do it again, only for this to possibly happen all over again at some future date. I would rather be poor and content and not targeted. And you know, that's ridiculous, because you're essentially taking out, you know, there are 500,000 or so paying parents now under the Child Maintenance Service. You know, quite a number of them would have previously been pretty bloody productive, you know, and they're being much less productive because they're like, well, what's the point? You know, so whilst they're extracting money on one side, they're losing the potential productivity of all those people on the other side. So it's a false economy anyway, and it's downright a crime against humanity, you know.
But they still make their money.
Ramola,
they still make their money.
Before I hand over to Tony.
Yeah.
A few years ago, when I called you, when I was dealing with all this, I found out that my records as a military man had been moved to Belfast. And I know there's a couple of us here that have served, the other guys here that have served in the province over in Northern Ireland. That alone is a huge security risk, to have Northern, like Belfast people dealing with your private and military information. It's like, I don't want to go through the layers of the onion with this, because it'll take forever, but that's ridiculous. I mean, who authorised that move?
It is a severe security breach, you know, because what Mark said there, that all of your military documents, all of your contact details, everything is over in Belfast, in Northern Ireland. And as you know, we had the United Kingdom was in conflict in,
that's right,
in Northern Ireland. So you know, it's pretty concerning to know that your information, especially now, there's still guys, the Belfast business unit has still got hold of people's information, you know. It's very concerning being a veteran, especially a veteran who served in Northern Ireland.
That's a very interesting kind of twist over here, that your military records would be taken over and put in Northern Ireland. I mean, that sort of brings up the question of global governance over here. You know, do we all have separate countries and separate nations? Do we have national sovereignty, or is there something else going on behind our backs? And has it been going on for a long time?
Ramona, can I give a quick brief about the DWP?
Yes, absolutely.
I'll just jump ahead. So my battle's been for about 16 years now. But I'm just going to jump ahead to 2012. I was awarded a legal aid certificate by the Legal Services Commission, exceptional funding to take my case to the Court of Appeal. And I eventually found a barrister, and the case was heard before His Honour Judge Simon Oliver at Reading County Court. Now, His Honour Judge Oliver, we now know, wasn't authorised to have dealt with that case. He didn't hold a court of protection authorisation, but he went ahead and heard it. The very next day, he telephoned my barrister, according to my solicitor, and my barrister withdrew from the case, and my solicitor told me I had to pay £10,000. I didn't have £10,000 to pay. Then, all of a sudden, in September, the senior district judge of the family division instructed that my case be sent to the Court of Protection and an appeal filed immediately, and that His Honour Judge Simon Oliver didn't hold a Court of Protection authorisation. When my solicitors sent my files, they were all screwed up in the box, and that's how they were sent to me. Then, in end of February 2013, I come under attack by the Department of Works and Pensions. I was fined £8,500 with no rights of appeal. And I was left to live below what the law says you require to live. At the same time, I came under attack by Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. And I was also notified in the same week I was under investigation by the Metropolitan Police. And there I was, with no money to live, under three investigations. Then, in September 2013, I get a phone call from the Department of Works and Pensions admitting that I had disclosed my pension. I was to appeal, and they would do the appeal for me. The appeal got reduced down to £2,500, and I appealed again. And the monies that I allegedly owed were confirmed that I didn't owe that money. It had been done maliciously to me. Revenue and Customs rang me up, and they said all that I owed them after a full investigation going into my tax affairs was £100. They gave me 3 years to repay that £100. Then I get a phone call from the Metropolitan Police saying that they've been asked to make my life difficult. They weren't going to. The officer, detective, identified himself as a former paratrooper, now in the reserves, and they named the government lawyer, the official solicitor of the High Court, as the person responsible for that. We now know what triggered all of this, that Mrs. Justice Palfrey had told His Honour Judge Simon Oliver to send my case to the Court of the Appeal. But by putting me under all these investigations and allegations and convictions of fraud, my case never got to the Court of Appeal. Anyway, fortunately, I've gained access to the Right Honourable Sir Geoffrey Cox, who's the former Attorney General, and he's given me the mechanism to set everything aside without the need of the courts. But it's been a very interesting process, seeing how it works and how you can be driven to suicide. Anyway, back to you.
That's an extraordinary story, Leonard, because it sounds like you've achieved the extraordinary over here. You were able to in some way invalidate all of this fraud that was laid at your doorstep. Did somebody help you? The Attorney General, you mentioned.
The security services came to my house. I was in the military, and they'd, I can't say who they are, but one of them is above the rank of a chief constable, has more power. And they wanted to view these court of protection certificates, which had been issued without a medical, to hold me for 1.5 years in a comatose state. And not one of these court of protection certificates has a court seal. But what's actually happened, in over 3 weeks ago, as I was leaving my home, we were going through files and we found a document. And what had happened, the way I escaped the mental health system from government lawyers called Helen Cliff in the official solicitor's office, Wing Commander Professor Turnbull intervened. He's a world authority on PTSD from the RAF. And he took control of my care away from the NHS. And on the 8th of February 2006, Professor Turnbull issued a Court of Protection CP2, which only a High Court family or Chancery judge or Court of Protection judge can view, no one else. And on that, he wrote about PTSD going back to 1984. It was re-triggered 20 years later. And Royal Navy PTSD specialist actually tracked it back to 1975. But what happened? Turnbull issued that Court of Protection certificate on the 8th of February. Am I going to send it to you? And they could take whatever action they like, and others. And it was issued on the 8th of February. And it goes into great detail about PTSD and trauma. And it makes reference to Court of Protection certificates where I'd been held for 1.5 years. What the government lawyer did, Helen Cliff, she obtained another report the next day with no reference to the Court of Protection or me being held or any reference to any Court of Protection certificate on it. When we had the meeting with the Right Honourable Sir Geoffrey Cox, again, I was driven there by two people from our security services. And we had a long chat with Mr. Cox, gave him 8 documents. And all that I asked of Mr. Cox, he's done immediately. And he actually wrote to the CPS at my request. They've given me the legal process with the Ministry of Justice to set everything aside. Now, I've had a lot of leaks, and Thames Valley Police has been an absolute nightmare. In 2018, it was found in just 1 year, over 35,000 crimes, including rape, sexual assaults, domestic violence, and vulnerable adult cases, were not being recorded by that force. I was frustrated with how I was being treated by Detective Inspector Gavin Tyrrell, but we've had the Office of Police Conduct have pulled all the files from another police force and sent those files to me. They've given them to me. And all the internal phone calls where the inspectors were saying how they were being bullied by their senior officers and being told what to do has all been released to me. And it's going to make for some interesting reading.
Wow.
Over to you.
That sounds like a major story. Craig just sent a note around saying, you know, there's an important aspect of your background that might be relevant, and that's you were a pilot for the Royal Family and for Margaret Thatcher.
Well, I actually joined the Royal Navy at the age of 18 as an ordinary seaman, and it was deemed that I wasn't suited for normal Royal Navy life. So my life was a bit different after that. And anyway, eventually I became, I qualified as a pilot, and I worked for British Aerospace, which was a manufacturer. And we used to fly a lot of government ministers and others. Then I went to work for another organization where we flew senior members of the royal family. We flew the Irish Taoiseach, which was the prime minister, and other people. But I can't really say too much about it. But I've had a lot of help. Even the former Attorney General, not only Geoffrey Cox, he has a keen interest in mental health. And he's, even though I'm not in his area now, I've got direct access to his office. The Right Honourable Dominic Greaves, QC, another former Attorney General, he's written to the police to investigate aspects of my life. And it was written down. It was a vexatious request. What Thames Valley Police are yet to find out. We've gained access to their police computer and we've got their notes. Got the whole lot, evidence it. But again, if, for instance, Michelle was to do a civil action or any of us against an MP or anyone, what they tend to do, they use in this country, they will use the Mental Health Act against you. Suddenly, in a, it'd be decided that you're mentally ill. You will be placed under the official solicitor of the High Court. It used to be Pobardo, Alistair Pobardo. And all of a sudden, all of your rights are taken away. You can't get, no one can get access to you. And he will hold you. He will asset strip you or his minions. But they're not authorised to make financial decisions on you. That has to go to the Court of Protection. But what they're not doing is disclosing your protected status to the Court of Protection. And that's what they're up to. And that's what we found out. And more importantly, I can evidence that. We've recovered 6 Court of Protection certificates. When they were inspected by a former provost marshal at my home, they had no barcodes on them, no serial numbers, no court seals, no audit trial. In the United Kingdom, if you go and buy a car today, it will have an MOT. If it's an old car, it have an MOT. You'll have to road tax it. You'll have to insure it. The Driving and Vehicle Licensing Authority will know whether that car's taxed, insured, MOT'd. With ARPN, they will know where you're driving it. They will know everything about that car. But if you get certified under the Mental Health Act, you disappear. Everything about you goes. And that's how they've been doing this, in a secret family court. If you dare to speak, you're at risk of imprisonment or the seizure of all your asset or both. In the case of His Honour Judge Simon Oliver at Reading County Court, we established that he'd actually been doing Court of Protection hearings for over 5 years when he weren't authorised. And he's made some horrendous orders. And even the journalist Christopher Brooker had written about one of his cases. He was silenced. And the Ministry of Justice has spent over £150,000 trying to take down this website and silence all criticism, this particular Masonic Freemason judge from Reading. Not all Freemasons behave like him, because some of them have been very kind and given me some information. But the fact is, he's been there and this is what he's been up to, and we now know. But anyway, back to you.
Actually, Len, I would like to explain to Romola that not only it was another
pre-written judgment, pre-written judgments,
a predetermined judgment.
Yeah,
but Len was also Romola, another victim, or should I say a victor, because that's what you'll be soon, of the family court frauds, and they asset stripped him of a house that was worth just under 1 million. But why we're on this point, Len, you've just made a very important point. And at the moment, everyone, I'm exposing this with the insolvency court frauds. You just said to me they weren't real court stamp seals on your court documents. So this is what I want to expose. I think the whole system is such a scam. We're in the middle of exposing that on the bankruptcy documents, they're not courts, proper court seal stamps. So if there's not no court seal stamp, there's no case to answer in law. So what I think we should all do is investigate all of our documents to prove that these are fraudulent documents and there's no, not even a court seal stamp, because they're asset stripping us.
Now, Michelle, two years ago, I sent to the Chief Constable of Thames Valley, John Campbell, and to the Deputy Chief Constable, Jason Hogg, a Court of Protection certificate. I sent it by recorded delivery and by email. And I've got the email and asked these two people, officers, whether these Court of Protection certificates are authentic. and there's been absolute silence. They haven't. But what I'll do, I'll now send that, remind them of that email, and do it publicly. And I will go to Mr. Not McFarland, Mr. Hayden, his number two. And let's have a very close look at these call to protection certificates, because on all one of them in particular, it's no more than a piece of A4 paper with the word call to protection typed on it. But it was sufficient to hold me and asset strip me. It was issued by Dr. Jeremy Rides, a private psychiatrist at Signet Healthcare, Godden Green, when three National Health Service doctors refused to sign a certificate of incapacity. They said my cognition was grossly intact. But once that certificate's taken, all your rights go. There isn't anything you can do. And then I looked at some of the fees. £4,000 to write two letters. That's what a solicitor charged. £4,000 for two letters. Then there was a court hearing. It lasted about 8 minutes. Present was a man by the name of Alistair Wilson. Alistair Wilson was the clinical director of trauma at the Royal London Hospital. He was the president of the British Trauma Society, and he founded the Royal London HEMS helicopter. He was deemed unsuitable to be my guardian. So was an army doctor, so was a navy doctor. They couldn't get me out until I was rescued by Gordon Turnbull. However, that hearing lasted in less than 10 minutes. I had a £10,000 cost order put on me by Dominic Brazil, One King's Bench Walk, with the full acknowledgement of the official solicitor's office who were present in that courtroom. As we know, many of our court tapes go missing. They all go missing, but fortunately I got the handwritten notes of Siobhan Bailey and others. Again, with emails, they delete their emails. You can't find the emails. But what we found, when you delete an email, an institution, what happens at night, for instance, on a solicitor's firm or an accountant's firm or barrister's chambers, everything is stored remotely, not in the building, but remotely. So what the barristers had done, they deleted their emails from their own computer, but what they couldn't do was delete it from their remote cloud computers. And that's where we found all the incriminated evidence on their remote storage computers. Back to you.
So Tony says he may need to leave soon. So perhaps we should hear his story as well. And then Mark's, and then we'll bring it right back to you, Michelle, because I know you have great responses to all of this and you have some ideas for solutions, which, you know, we don't want to leave this panel without talking about solutions. So go ahead.
Sorry, my daughter wants me to pick her up soon from work. So sorry about that. My case has been going on for 28 years. It's kind of coming to an end now. Split from my first wife, met somebody else, went on to have further children, and paid maintenance, child maintenance, as I should, a responsible parent. They never included my second relationship. And I argued this for two decades, and they were not having it. Whilst I was in the army, I carried on paying £350 a month without any notice, opted to £550 a month, which was probably 35% of my wages. When I had I already had a family and some other children, so I couldn't exist on that sort of money. So I left the army. At the time, I had a massive breakdown, and I stupidly attempted suicide, which I'm not proud of.
You're okay, brother.
We're
so okay.
Sorry, Tony.
It was a really bad time. I was put on a zero balance thing. I can't remember what they called it for about 18 months. I received my war pension. I was later diagnosed with PTSD. But trust me, when I say my reasons for that attempt were because of the child maintenance service, the I had two bailiff visits to my house. They put a block on the sale of my house. They put give me a 6-week suspended prison sentence. Sorry, 6-week prison sentence, suspended for 2 years. Threatened to take my license off me. Laughed at me on the phone when I was crying to them. Actually laughed and said tough. Right. At one point when I was paying £800. Eventually, after all the threats and everything, we came to an agreement on the arrears just to pay. They wouldn't listen to me saying, you've got this wrong. They absolutely wouldn't listen to me. So I just paid it. My ex-wife died 2 years ago, and I was told, unbelievably, that I had to pay her husband, who never raised my children. He came along later. So I had to pay him as the executor of her estate. He promised that he would give the money to the children. I argue that this can't be right, but it's their policy that that's what you must do. I carried on arguing about the arrears. They said, tough, you know, you never told us that you had a new relationship. Yes, I did. I got in contact with Craig and Clive, who helped me to move this further. I got my SAR, which is my... All my file was sent to me. It took 15 minutes to find a letter that I sent to them in 1997 about and forms that I completed about my relationship. So they've always known. They've always known from day one that I had another relationship. So all my arguing just fell on deaf ears. They ignore me completely. I went to the media recently, and my story's been in the papers about paying my dead ex-wife's husband. My daughter saw this story and contacted me saying, we've never received any money from him. What's this about? And it turns out that he's kept it all for himself.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Incredible.
My case has since been closed. The outstanding arrears have been written off. I've had a small refund. The current situation is it's with ICE being investigated with my new evidence that I get sent them a letter and that I had said this 20 years ago. And I'm hoping that I will get quite a big refund. Having spoken to the Child Maintenance Service, it's a specialist office that you can't contact normally. She did give me her details and she said we will give you the money that you're owed. And we will chase him for it, his or her estate through him. So it's been a massive, awful adventure. I mean, to tell my children from my second relationship that I might be going to prison, or what for, Daddy? What have you done? Nothing. I've done nothing. It was a really, like Mike was saying earlier, I don't want to go back into that. Going back, reading those files was really upsetting. And I can understand how people find that dark place in their life and you don't see a way out. It's awful. And I don't envy anybody that goes through that. I don't. It's, yeah.
It's torture.
It absolutely is. It is. And like I said, that woman laughed at me on the phone. I was paying £800 a month. I was a truck driver, not a bank manager. 800 a month, and I was crying, saying, I can't live. Tough. She just laughed at me and said, tough. I'm like, what? What about my children to my second wife? How am I supposed to feed them? They've missed out on so much as well. I mean, surely the welfare of all children is paramount, not just my greedy ex-wife that constantly pursued them for money.
There's a section to the Child Support Act, 91. This particular welfare of all children in the case when they make a decision, it's section two.
But the children, don't forget, the children, they're making money. The children, they're supposed to protect the children, but they're not. So, you know, this is where you've got to look at it. It's a cash cow. I'm sorry, it's a cash cow. All right, it's just wrong.
You know, can I make an observation?
I think you've all established it's organized class warfare. It's an extortion racket. And it's a cash. It's organized crime. You know,
I would have been still paying to this day had it not been for Craig and Clive. I honestly would still be paying because I had nothing I could do. They just said, tough, you're paying it. Or bailiffs again will take. The last conversation I had with when they set up a DOE was that if you don't pay that, we'll take more. That's what he actually said to me on the phone. We'll take one. I recorded that, and I said, "That's a threat, mate." He says, "Well, that's what'll happen."
It's just an observation. There's an observation that I've right. There's a lot of ex-service people here, and it seems like we're the top of the iceberg. We're the tip. We're the toughest of the top. For every one of us, there's probably 20, 30 guys who have fallen by the wayside. They haven't got the sort of the fortitude or the sort of, you know, the gumption to keep going for this. And we're the remnants of it. We're still fighting. We're still going up against the CMS. But the amount of guys who have fallen by the wayside, who have given up, who have just given into the CMS, given into the bullies, right? We're here because we are who we are. We're from what I can gather, a lot of us are ex-service personnel who have decided to go that extra step forward, put ourselves in front of everybody else to protect everybody else. And we're still doing that today. We're still doing that today with our training, whatever. We're still doing that today. And we still have that sort of cape on our backs. We still want to jump into fires. We still want to do this. But there's, for every one of us, there's probably 20, 30, 40 guys who have fallen by the wayside. They can't take this. So this is way bigger than we realize. But we have to get everybody. We've got to get everybody together.
I agree. And I think what we have to do is get the men and women together, because this isn't about men and women. This is about a system. This is about a system.
A system that is disgusting.
Right. Can
if
I,
all of
can
us
I
got
just...
together, we could honestly move mountains. But we have to get and, you know, cohesively get together, and then we could do something. But
we need to march on Parliament. That's what we need to do. We need to march on Parliament, all of us. That's what we need to do.
They've got us divided. They've got us all divided, individual battles, and we're all separate. If we all club together.
I agree.
But Mark, the way the government works, and every government does it, divide and conquer, left against right. And it's divide and conquer all the time. Look, they've got three units. Within the Cabinet Office, one's called the Nudge Unit, which is they use a behavioural tool, it's behavioural science, which Craig will tell you. They send out letters on a Friday, so it gives you mental health, running high. They've got a Rapid Response Unit, which was enforced, and it was a fight against terrorism, or at the unacceptable in social media. Anybody who has a voice today on this social media, you have become who you're the terrorist towards the government, because you're calling out the government, and that's what they don't want.
Mm.
Where we need to come together, men and women, we've got so much unrest at the moment in the United Kingdom, across the world. It's time to say enough is enough. We elect them. But when we elect members of Parliament to government, they're only there for 5 years. It's the civil servants behind who run our government, and the corporates, they've got their fingers in their pies. That's where we are. You know, let's make no bones about this. Protection for our children, this is. Men and women need to get together because the children are our future.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you connect that to what's going on now with the children being forced to wear masks in school and in colleges all day, you know, and workers of different kinds as well being forced to do things, there's so much tyranny, there's so much imposition that if the adults don't stand up and speak for the children, you know, the children, their lives are being taken over.
Well, I think this has been a great panel, Ramona, especially where we did the first one. We did it with the, you know, where the women, the mothers, it's the same situation.
Yes.
And I think what we can do with all the people I'm working with, I think we join together, and then if we get Brian to then have, as he's going to suggest, Brian, maybe you can suggest, you can have a database where we join everyone together, and then we come up with a plan of action, how we're going to target this to stop it.
I think Clive also had some very good suggestions earlier on, where he mentioned that you're dealing actually with private corporations, right? These yes. agencies are all private.
Yeah.
So, and you, and you also talked about fraudulent court documents. And I think, Clive, you mentioned the name of a company that's behind a lot of this, right?
Yeah. You've only got to look at it. Craig, what I forgot.
Serco and Tata Steel.
Serco, I tell you who they are. I've got them by here in the document I've got in front of me, actually. Capita Services Limited, Management Service Limited. All right, Capita. So, is it Capita Services Limited? Let me have a look.
There's Capita and the Serco and the Tata.
Yeah.
And Serco.
Serco. Back to Serco.
Back to Serco.
It all leads back to the same corporates. It's big corporates. And yeah, we've got to take them. Mark hasn't shared his yet. I'm looking forward to Mark's story, actually.
No. Has Tony finished, though? Did Tony finish?
Tony, have you finished?
Yeah.
I think
Briggsy was going to say something as well, weren't you, before? Briggsy?
All right. Agent technology. Yeah, I was just saying that what Mark has said about the amount of people who are just paying the money just because that's the easy way out. And that when you look into it, and I've been doing a lot of looking into it recently, there are loads and loads of people who know it's wrong. The CMS won't listen to them, and they just end up paying it because that is the easy way out. There's nothing else they can do. There's nowhere they can go, nobody they can turn to, and nobody will listen to them. So they just pay the money.
Here's the interesting thing about it is, and Brian touched on it before, is, you know, people are forced almost to suicide, or, you know, they're in well paid employment or whatever, but they struggle with mental health, and then they're forced out of work. And so for the short term gain of a lot of money being taken by the child maintenance service, the government are actually losing out, because that person who was productive and working and providing tax is no longer paying tax, and then the government is actually having to pay for their benefits. So really, who's losing out? It's the government that's losing, because they're losing out on the tax and having to pay out. And the CMS, they're causing more damage than good, because they're at times forcing people to suicide, and each suicide is costing the taxpayer £1.7 million.
It's a number game. It's a number.
A thousand suicides a year, over 1,000 suicides at 1.7 million, that comes into billions now, doesn't it? So they're costing the taxpayer more than anything.
Yeah, but the thing is that they don't notice that cost, you see, you know. So when we say the government, you know, what really is the government? It's not like a being, is it? You can't, you know, if you blame the government, it's a massive institution. You can't lay blame on a government. Where you can lay blame is on individuals who are, you know, creating policies that cause problems in order. And those policies are being created in order for them to create numbers that they're ticking a box and saying, look how wonderful I am, look what I did. So it's a career driven corruption, or it's a, you know, in the case of family law, you know, there's direct defrauding going on where those individuals are directly financially benefiting. And, you know, I dare say that there is, you know, knowing how much resource there is in government in terms of behavioral sciences, you know, that they must have they must understand what this does to people. So, you know, when you've got those level of resources to be able to map that out, you do start to lean into conspiracy theories of, well, you know, do they want this dysfunction? Because no right-minded person would create policies like this. No right-minded person would inflict this sort of harm. So, and while they're seeing the output of it and the destruction it's causing, if they had got it wrong, they would have remedied it. They wouldn't have just carried on for 28 years doing the same thing and making it worse and silencing everybody that's screaming at them to please stop. They would do something. So,
but Brian, remember what we opened it up with. The Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, who we all took oath to serve the Queen and country, she's actually turned around and said, you know, be open for criticised and accountability. This government, they're not open to be criticised, accountability. And Capita Business Services Limited, which work with DWP, also Serco, because they use our law system, Serco. All right, they'd all... people got fingers in the pies. That's why they...
I mean, but they have. But the point I'm making is that, you know, it's not just this government. It's the one before and the one before and the one before and the one before. So you know, you can't get to a person that's ultimately accountable. Right. You know, there are numerous people over numerous years that have continued
Let's go back to 1981.
Guys, hang on a second. Mark, yeah. Mark's got to go. Can you just check Mark's case before? Mark, are you able to speak before you go?
Who, me?
Yes, Mark did. Mark talked about his case. Mark Appleby, I think.
Mike on mine. Mark Price.
No, Mark Price.
For me.
Yes, Mark Price hasn't told us his story. I think you made a general observation about what's happening. Do you want to cover it briefly?
My story. Oh damn. My story is not well. I don't know where to start.
It's extreme, Mark. It's extreme.
Pardon?
It's quite extreme.
My story was my life was okay. 12 years in the army, full engineers. Everything is good. I've come 2006, 2007. I met this woman. Initially, the relationship was okay. She had a child from a previous relationship. When I met her, she'd sort of said that this guy was domestic violence. He was horrible. He was like an ogre. There's all sorts of stuff. Looking back now, there are red flags everywhere. I should have just walked off. But I'm not this guy. I'm not the guy that she just left. I'm not this fella. We've got into a relationship now. We've had a child. And within a year of that child, my daughter being born, she's gone. Right, she just is. I came in from work, and the stuff's gone. I've gone into court. I've started to put the paperwork into court. You know, and apparently she's moved back to her sister's. I've been in touch with her sister. I can't get any correspondence from her. My ex comes back to the house to pick up some more stuff, so she's fine. And I said, "Well, what's going on? What's going on?" She doesn't say much of anything. She disappears again. I then sort of, I then fill in the paperwork for court. We go to court and then there's allegations of domestic violence, right? Nothing's ever happened. Nothing's ever gone on. There's nothing. That was in 2009. 2011, I'm going to jump forward now. There's loads of stuff that went on between that. But 2011, there's a final hearing, 127 different allegations I'd faced from, during this period, I'd gone into a contact center. Apparently I'd attempted to molest my own one-year-old child in the contact center whilst I was changing a nappy, right? That was one allegation. Allegations of There's too many. There's too many. That was one of the worst ones. There's loads of different other ones. So with that, there's 127 allegations. We go to a final hearing. There's a Section 47 report being done by the local authority, who then find out that my ex-partner had a relationship with the woman who ran the contact centre, and they were making false reports about me, right? So they're writing false reports, submitting them to court. Kafkas were getting hold of them, and everybody believed them. Everybody believed what she was doing. Everybody believed what she was saying and the statements and everything else, and it was just horrible, absolutely horrible. I had a breakdown during it, and I was sort of shocked at the breakdown because I've served 12 years in the army. I've seen odd bits and pieces. I'm not going to go into detail, but I thought if anything was going to get me, that would have got me. That time in the army would have got me. But the stuff that was going on now was disgusting. That's the best way I can describe it. It was disgusting. And I went to doctors and everything else, and they said, you know, I've had a mental breakdown because of what was going on in my life. And it's all brought on by what this woman was doing to me. Anyway, so during that period, I did run a company, a small sort of interior fit-out company. We're doing quite well, but I couldn't focus on work. I couldn't do anything. I just couldn't function. And during that same period, the CSA contacted me. They wanted the company. By this time, I'd closed the company down. The company was now gone. So in 2008, 2009, the company's going into liquidation. I decided to close the company down. So I'm self-employed. 2010, the CSA get hold of me, saying that I'm a director of a company. They estimate that this company is worth, you know, something like £500,000. It's nowhere near that. They estimate that I owe up to £9,000 in missed arrears, in missed payments. I dispute that in 2011, because in 2009 and 10, I was having a bit of a mental breakdown. So years on, this arrears is still going on. They're still fighting it. They wanted to take my house. So they wanted to put an order for sale of my own property. And so they tried to go for an order of sale for my own property. I then bumped into Craig, and Craig's been helping me through this. I know it sounds all confusing at the moment. It's all over the place. But so in 2019, So I'm seeing my daughter. So all this has gone on. So 2011, the case is finished. I'm seeing my daughter from 2011 till now, right? We've got contact order in place. I'm seeing my daughter on a regular basis. Everything's fine. So 2018, 19, the CSA get on my case again about these arrears stemming back from 2009. I get hold of Craig, and we've gone through it, and basically these are fictitious arrears. The arrears are built up over a limited company that didn't exist at the time, and these are figures that were made up. So we've then got all the figures together. We've gone to court in November of 2019, and the court agrees that these figures could be fictitious, and we were to supply our own findings and present it to the court. We were doing this, but the CMS then contacted the mother and told her that she'd lost the case. She wasn't going to get the £9,000, and she wasn't going to get the force of the sale of the house. I turned to Craig that very same day. I said, I guarantee within 3 months, it's going to kick off. She's going to kick off. Something's going to happen. Almost to the day, the mother stopped me seeing my daughter. And I've not seen her since because of that. And we're back in court now. I got another final hearing in May to go back to court because the mother has been doing this, trying to alienate me from my own child all along. There's a lot more to the story, and to go into detail would take another hour. And I'm trying to sort of boil it down. But essentially, she wanted the child. She didn't want me. She wanted to do everything that she possibly could to get rid of me. Allegations, all sorts of stuff. And I'm still here. And the funny thing was with Craig last October. Again, like one of the other guys on here, I've got other children. I've told the CSA that I've got other children and they've not listened to me. I've sent them birth certificates, I've sent them bits and pieces, and they won't take my other children on board. And it's only just recently they've taken my other children on board, and they're now starting. I've got a 7-year-old child and an 11-year-old child, but they haven't taken any of those children on board when they're doing their calculations. And now they've taken them on board, they won't backdate it to the date of their birth. They'll start it from October onwards. Because I said that.
Mark, how has it affected you? How has it affected you and the family? That's the biggest question now. Because
when I joined up, I could say I was quite naive. I joined up and the government knew exactly what they're doing. Every single policeman was honest. All officials were there to do us a service, like I was to do them a service. I joined up 12 years. I did my bit for what I was protecting. I was protecting everything at home. I was looking after Blighty when I was going off to do my bit. That's what I thought I was doing, right? And I believe that when I leave, the day I leave the army, I'm going to be treated in the same way. They're going to look after me. I'm a veteran. They're going to look after me. They're going to, And I'm affected more by the disappointment, right? I've come back and I've been kicked in the teeth, slapped in the mouth, I've been everything, right? It's like my 12 years didn't matter. It didn't matter at all, right? I went for housing. When I left the army, you're entitled to, you served in the army, you can get a house. You can get a council house, right? The time you've served in the army counts as your time on a sort of council list. Right, yeah. I've come out of the army. I've gone to the local authority. Right, I'm an ex-soldier, just leaving the army. I'm looking for some sort of housing. I would like to put my name on a council list. Right, you'll get something within 3 months. Right, 3 months, 4 months into it, nothing. I've gone back to the council. Right, what's going on? Right, every recovering alcoholic, pregnant teenager, foreign national, blah, 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 all those people can get a house. Before I can get a house, right? Yep. So, and because I'm a fit, healthy young man, there's no reason why I should be on the council list. And I just got kicked off.
And Romola, listen to this now. Listen to this. We have a justice system in the UK. You're innocent until proven guilty. You're innocent beyond reasonable doubt until proven guilty. But the way the system works, exactly the same as the health and safety system. Mark, he's disappeared on me.
I'm still here. I'm just going to go off something. I'm just going to go and do something.
Yeah. So, Mark, just a quick question.
Yeah.
And everybody on you will understand where Mark comes from. Does this work in the child maintenance service? Are you innocent until proven guilty? Or is it you're guilty until you prove yourself innocent?
You're guilty. That's what they say.
Guilty as long as I'm breathing.
Mm.
Yeah. So, and that's the biggest problem you got, Romola. You're guilty until you prove yourself innocent. And a lot of times you can't prove yourself innocent because they just got you marked.
I went to a solicitor a number of times and not one of them would touch my case. Not one of them. Right. At one point, I was below the threshold where I could get legal aid, and I couldn't get legal aid. Nobody would trust me. Nobody would touch me against the CSA or the CMS. Not one person.
Even though you've got a juicy case, which I had, and no law firm will give you representation.
Again?
But it's the same as here.
That's the familiar thing, isn't it? We've all said that none of the solicitors, nobody will take on the CMS.
Ian is fighting a case at the moment. Nobody's willing to back him, and he's guilty. He's lost his son. He's guilty until he proves that everything, he's innocent, or his son was innocent. However, they're not interested. They've shut in all the doors.
And the coroner won't listen to the evidence.
That's disgusting.
This is just absolutely heartbreaking all around. I mean, it just sounds like brick walls. You're being stonewalled at every turn. And people being seen, you know, justice has been turned on its head over here. And, you know, when you talked about earlier about how the CMS treats people, I think that's a dead giveaway. So they're not interested in creating bridges or keeping the door open and hearing the true stories and taking into account all of the, you know, considerations, taking all of the elements into consideration, the other children from a second marriage or a lowered income. Instead, they're working very hard on making people homeless. They are asset stripping. They are setting the bailiffs on you all and taking your houses away. So, I mean, this is why I say use the word class warfare. You know, this is like they're trying to create poverty and push people lower down the ladder in terms of socioeconomic ability. Right,
I think
Michelle?
What we need now is another glorious revolution. It's about that time now. You know, it's been a few hundred years. We're budding for a glorious revolution, you know.
Absolutely. Well,
absolutely, yeah.
Clive, can I just say something?
Yes.
Why don't we all get together and, like I said, march on Parliament? All of us. Get everybody together. Then they're going to have to listen to it.
Mark, at the moment with the bill they've passed, is what's got to happen now is on the 22nd of August, the veterans are marching anyway in London. They're going to do a big rolling thunder because of all the veterans we're losing to suicide and we're not getting support. But what we need to do is get rid of the left party, get rid of the right party. Everybody is protesting because they've got a message to the government. They're not happy. So everybody needs to drop the left party, the right party, because that's division. And everybody needs to come together. And we need to bring change. This government, all this has been going on since 1981. Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, they looked at privatisation, corporates, and it's how many people do you know goes into politics and they become millionaires when they come out the other side, man? It's unbelievable. And only when we come together as a unite, when we unite as the United Kingdom and we stop having this Antifa left side, right side, I don't know what left and right is. I've been called a right wing. I've been called right wing because I'm a veteran. And it's divide and conquer. They always have the divide and conquer in place. And it's wrong. It's wrong.
We can label as being right wing, as being a veteran, but there you've got Mark.
Yeah.
He's a veteran. Is he right wing?
Exactly. No, but it's look at the way they treat our Commonwealth. We got Fijians. Yeah. They recruited. I've got friends from the Caribbean. I've got friends from Fiji and Ghana. And they can't even get residency after doing 12 years in the British military.
Serving the British country, you know, serving the British crown. And they can't even stay in the United Kingdom after they served. It was the same with the Gurkhas as well. You know, the Gurkhas got shat on by the government, had to go back, and we've got the same stuff going on with the Commonwealth. which we need to talk about as well at some point, Romola. Remember I was telling you the idea there about...
Yes, absolutely. We were talking about doing a different focus on that. Absolutely. Yeah, we should do that, correct? Yeah. It sounds like, you know, just listening to... I mean, there is so much angst. Yeah, there's so much drama. There's so much stress. And you are all rightfully upset. It seems like the stage has been set now for all of you to put your heads together and try to figure out what to do next. But I can tell you, just the fact that you've spoken out today on this panel is huge. And isn't it, Michelle? I mean, because I think our first panel was sort of huge, right? And you sent it around to everybody. And that video is still being watched madly on all my channels. So I think this panel is huge. The fact that you've spoken out, because at this point, you've made very clear what the very many problems are and all the many different the agencies of the government, so-called government, which are actually private corporations, the government themselves, the MPs who don't respond to you, etc. And everything that you have laid out here, which, you know, needs to be pulled together. I'll try to pull it together in an article shortly, but I'll post the panel right away first. And, you know, you are, I think, at the beginning of making a difference, but perhaps there are many solutions to be brought to the table, not just one. Perhaps a march in parliament is indeed a great idea, and perhaps forming an organization, which Brian has done, the United Parents Organization, is a good one. And, you know, I'd also like to invite each of you to come and tell your stories separately on my shows. I particularly thought Ian Briggs and Leonard Lawrence had incredible stories that are offering whistleblowing insights into the structure of the government, because both of you have encountered people inside these agencies who have come forward to help you. And I think also Tony Booth mentioned a kind of a turning around of his case toward the end. So those are the kinds of stories which, you know, give you whistleblower insights as well.
So, Romola, the problem that we've been up against is the fact that, you know, the mainstream media, like the law firms, will go nowhere near these stories. You know, you've got what we're labelled as in the media as deadbeats. Okay. Yeah.
The media is connected to the lawyers, it sounds like. What do you think, Michelle?
Well, it's all part of the same corporation, isn't it? The mainstream media is owned by six corporations, which all links back to Serco and the Crown Corporation.
That's right.
So you've got the spider's web with all its tentacles everywhere. Mm. So I think, you know, one of the solutions is this. Maybe you could put across the database that you've set up, and we can share that with our audience this evening so that everyone can join that database. And then we can start showing who's involved, which law firms, which judges. And then maybe we start, then we're seeing that it's the same judges, it's the same law firms, the same people with CMS. We start targeting the same individuals, and then maybe we should do some class actions on private prosecutions, just the thought.
The saddest part you is we're only scratching the surface, all right? We've got Graham House with Justice for Troops, who about sexual assault in the military, which is covered over, rape, and what we are trying to do is sit with the government to offer solutions, because the people on Europe have gone through it. They know what's wrong and they know what needs to be done. However, it just needs to change. And we've offered solutions. Nobody's willing to listen. That's the problem.
Clive, the one thing that really annoys me is I serve my country. You know, like Mark said, a lot of us, like I think nearly all of us on here, are veterans. We served our country. We don't deserve this. We don't deserve to be penalised for something that we, you know, I don't owe this money. And it's just ridiculous. It's scary. Why is it so many veterans are being penalised for this? That's what I'd like to know.
It's not just veterans, mate. It's the armed forces.
I know.
That's scary. There's the fact that we have special forces who are more frightened of the CMS than they are of going to Afghanistan or on operational tour.
The forces and the vets are easy targets, aren't they?
So yeah, we're easy targets. The thing is, armed forces are very easy targets, easy pickings for the child maintenance service. Yeah. And the thing is, it's causing operational effectiveness. You know, we were talking to Graham House a while ago. He was a wing commander of a fighter unit. He was doing an operational sortie, which he had to cancel because he his systems operator couldn't function because he had his head up his backside because of the CSA. Just couldn't function.
And the worst thing is, I'm going to put it out there. It's not just service personnel. There's a lot of people suffering today with mental
emergency
health.
Emergency services.
Especially with COVID. Mm. Emergency services. You know, don't forget, if you work for the government, they're your paymaster. So if you're in uniform representing the government, I'll tell you what I would love to do. And this is a big shout out to Mr. Boris. You got 6 kids. I would love to see what he's, I'd love to see what he's doing with CMS because he's got 6 children. Boris, really? Boris Johnson, our Prime Minister, I wonder if he pays the same as these guys on you. And that's all I'm going to say now. I've had enough now.
Well,
good on you, Clive.
Well, thank you, each of you, for your contributions today. I mean, it's been sort of an amazing panel today. And clearly it's a conversation that needs to be kept going. So, you know, kudos to all of you for coming together. And hopefully these database actions will also proceed. We should probably be thinking about closing this panel today. We've been kind of going on for a very long time. So perhaps if anybody has last words, like Clive, to issue forth, feel free. This is the moment. And then we'll close.
I think
I apologize if my thing wasn't coherent. You just, I wasn't expected to talk or anything, so I haven't lined
anything
up.
Was very coherent. I think you gave us your story, Mark. I mean, it's heartbreaking, just like everybody else's. And, you know, it's very sad that you can't see your daughter at this point in time.
I'll get her back.
Yeah, and you're forced, just like everyone else, to keep going to the court and keep sort of knocking on the doors of the court. So there has to be a better way, as all of you were saying. Perhaps common law is the answer, and perhaps invalidating these systems, these agencies, these private corporations, in some way cutting loose those ties. I would recommend looking into live-life claims and returning to the land and, you know, getting rid of the legal fiction, the straw man, because that's what I've been exploring. And, you know, I think that's sort of a great solution, but it also has a lot of work associated with it. What do you think, Michelle?
I actually think I'm going back to our Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Our Bill of Rights overrides the Crown Corporation, and I think if we enforce it, because the MPs under our Constitution, they are our civil servants. They work for us. It's not the other way around. Mm. We, the people, are the taxpayers. They work for us.
That's wonderful. But how do you make that happen? How do you enforce it with them? Because they don't even answer letters and phone calls, right?
Michelle, look at the said rights claimed of the Bill of Rights. The clause, the said rights claimed. Have you read that?
I haven't read that, no.
You need to read that part. That's it's where if you're damaged by the state or the Crown, then they have to put you right.
Well, I work with John Bingley, who's our leading constitutional expert and on the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, John Bingley.
And you know, like they're doing in the US, the Bill of Rights is very powerful. You know, and I have to say, Joe, I think if we stuck to that, and I think we've got to break this system down. And I think, you know, having databases, I think we've got to do some private prosecutions on Class A actions. We've got to break this down, this system, to change it and reform it. Criminals. And I'm sorry we've got to remove the head of the snake. Who's the head of the snake? The Crown Corporation that controls Serco, controls all of this. And until we remove that, we are not going to get anywhere.
But with the biggest problem we've got is they write regulations at the end of the day to protect themselves. They write regulations and acts and bills and orders in Parliament to protect the bigger players. And unless the police and our service personnel, everybody comes together, you're never going to go down that road of common law. They will just shut us down every time because they will use the army. They will use everybody in uniform. That's why everybody's got to come together. It's the only way you can do it. You know?
Coming together is always a powerful solution. You know, there's always power and strength in numbers. Everybody speaking out together is definitely going to be making a huge impact.
Definitely. And, you know, look, at the end of the day, what I'm going to say is, anybody out there suffering, all right, there's always light at the end of the tunnel. What we fear a lot of the times when we tell ourselves in there, false evidence appearing real, it's lies in our conscious mind. We need to connect, and because what you fear never comes true. So we've just, if anybody's out there listening to this show and they're feeling really in a bad place, get in touch, talk to somebody, share where you are. Only by sharing, and this is what I learned when I was loading the snake's belly, was only when I started talking to people and started clearing my emotions. And a lot of men got to do that, because we're losing a lot of men to suicide because they don't show their emotions.
Is there an ID, that email ID that people can, that we can give out, that people can use to reach out to you, Clive, or to Brian Hudson, or to, you know, the group over here? To grow.
Yeah, we'll sort something out there.
Yeah, and send it to me. I'll stick it below the video, you know, so people have some kind of means of communication with you all, perhaps.
Romola, my call of protection certificates, all based on Professor Wing Commander, Professor Turnbull, World Authority on PTSD, and it talked about me, but why don't we use that as a basis of a PTSD show?
Okay, definitely. I think it definitely sounds like we do need to do a focus on PTSD and mental health, and also mental health fraud, you know.
I mean, they pushed me to the limits, but what saved me was having two German shepherds. It gave me a purpose to get up in the morning, to feed the dogs, to walk the dogs. But yes, they pushed me to the limit with no money to live.
Oh. But
because I had the two dogs...
Yeah, the dogs. I see Craig's dog over there. That's very sweet.
Yeah.
Looks a bit like my dog. So, yeah, animals can be life-saving.
Forget the medication. It was the processing. And what Professor Turnbull did, he got me to write a chronology, line by line. I'll give you a sample of it. Then we went through it eventually and working where all the triggers were. And a lot of them were in the family courts and a lot of false allegations.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Yeah, definitely, Leonard. I think that's a good idea for a future show.
We could put it up as an example for people to follow. And let's do a PTSD and put it out towards the military and others. Then hopefully that, because you're going to, if you get to a mental health institute, the chances are they're going to give you tablets and tell you to go away. You've got to dig deep. You've got to understand. Once you understand it, you can process it.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's a great idea. Anyone else before we close for today?
I was going to say,
never give up.
Yeah, I'm a sapper. We never give up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fabulous. So those are all the power things from the military that, you know, you can help put out there. So
once a squaddy, always a squaddy.
So everybody, thank you all so much for being here, for speaking out, for sharing your stories, and for helping give encouragement and solace to other people listening who may be in similar situations. And as Mark Price said earlier, for every one of you who's speaking, there's 30 or 40 who have fallen by the wayside. So, you know, this is a terrible situation, and whichever way you look at it, solutions do need to be formed, and coming together and speaking out may be the first step toward that.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. God bless everyone. Right. Never give up, as you all have said. And thanks, everyone, for watching. And we'll see you again another time. Bye for now.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.